It's time for Valley Writers Read, a production of Valley Public Radio featuring the talents of writers from Central California. Here's the host of our program, Franz Weinschenk.
Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. Tonight, the story of Whistle, a girl who didn't really want to talk to anyone until she was 16 and pregnant. The writer is Judy Ryan, who's certainly no stranger to Valley Writers Read, not only for her own fine stories, but also for her outstanding interpretation of other writers' stories. Her story tonight is called Whistle Stop, and here she is, Judy Ryan.
Whistle Stop. I found my granddaddy in 1997, the year I turned 16, the year I stole myself out of Barstow and planted myself in front of a lawyer. Oh, yes, and the year I took my first ever long, hungry ride on a train. And not a single one of those things would have happened had I not gotten, as my brother would have said, and one of the many reasons I didn't tell him, knocked up. So that's probably the best place to start. I was bored, angry, and curious. Not a good combination. I hadn't spoken a complete sentence since I was 7. I was without experience, expectation, or optimism. Jay Bratt had been drinking but was not drunk, and he reached for me with hands that seemed to know what they were doing. His hair was matted, but his nails were clean, and unlike his friend who had studded leather bands around his wrists and cryptic symbols tattooed across his knuckles, Jay Bratt had no rings, no marks, no metal, just a tipsy grin and straight teeth. They stood there, the two of them, with smoky smiles, calculating their chances of where they were at the right place at the right time. "Jay Bratt," I said, "you feel lucky?" And with that, his friend disappeared in a way I can only describe as gentlemanly. Jay Bratt looked shocked at first, not because of what I had said, but because I had actually said it. We were in high school, and he had known me since second grade or maybe before, but had never heard me speak. And the reason for that is because I didn't. I mean, I could if I had to. I didn't. And people acted like that was the way it was supposed to be, not knowing or perhaps not bothering to know that I was screaming inside for someone to pull out my voice. And so it was. Jay Bratt got lucky. The only thing that stands out in my mind about that night, that experience, is nothing much. And the next day, Monday, I passed Jay Bratt twice between classes. I didn't look at him, and he didn't look at me. I was pretty sure I could talk myself into believing it had never even happened. So I was almost 6 months pregnant before I allowed myself to realize it. The prospect had buzzed around me like a lazy fly, rarely lighting down where I could examine it closely. When it finally did, the bulge inside me was like an active throb, and I knew for the second time in my life I had to act decisively, and I did so in ways I wouldn't have thought myself capable. I had no friends, probably for good reason. I wasn't friendly. My mom had been in a vacant state since I was 7, and I couldn't bear dumping one more problem on my dad on the few occasions he was around, especially since, despite his efforts, I'd been no more friendly to him than I had been to the stranger who weekly picked up our garbage. I left a note before I took off. I left it on my brother's guitar. I knew he wouldn't care much, but I also knew he'd get it to my dad. I made it as vague but positive as I could. "Jason, tell Dad I got a job up north. It's a live-in situation cleaning up after an old woman. I think it will be good for me to earn some money. If she dies or gets better, I'll be back, but I don't know if that will happen. Whistle." My name, of course, was Jennifer. But there were at least 3 girls in my class with the same name, so when Jason started calling me Whistle, it sort of got around. He was an active type, someone people listened to, though rarely. In his mind, whistle was a way to goad me, the result of a conversation I wasn't having with his friend. As I recall, it went like this. "What's your sister's name? Jennifer? Yo, Jennifer. Turn the volume up," motioning to the TV. I was reading at the time and convinced the TV couldn't get any louder. I ignored him. "Doesn't talk much, does she?" Jason nodded to the rhythm of a sitcom laugh track. I said, and his Neanderthal friend leaned toward me, raising his voice like I was a deaf mute. "I said, you don't talk much, do you?" I pretended to read. "Is everything okay in there?" And he prodded my head with his forefinger. Jason pulled away from the TV to watch. "Say something. Whistle if you have to." My patience was gone. I looked up from my book. His face couldn't have been more than 3 inches away, menacing and lewd. I hated him. I hated Jason for bringing him into my space and not knowing I could even do it. I put my lips together just inches from his scabby nose and whistled. A slow, steady stream of air, low-pitched and obstinate. The air hit his eyes, so he had to blink, the action giving me a victory neither of us expected. Jason thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever seen and spent the odd moments of his pointless life trying to get me to do it again, which I never did. So Jason started calling me Whistle, and to his surprise, I not only responded, I signed my school papers with it. And then I signed it as my name when I wrote a note telling him I was leaving the family for as long as I could manage to stay away. It has been 10 years now, and no one has made an effort to bring me back, though I contacted them all once I was well established and of an age that could stand on its own. But at the time, I was afraid there was a real danger my parents would somehow get it together enough to drag me back to Barstow. I chose not to take money from either of them for this escape, but I sold Jason's capo, his guitar strap, and an electronic tuner to a stranger on eBay. You don't have to talk to make things happen on eBay, and apparently you don't have to be able to match pitch to play the guitar, so I figured after the years of torture I endured from Jason, this made us even. To be fair, I wrote on the note under my signature, P.S., "Don't look for your capo or guitar strap or that tuner thing. They're all in Oklahoma with some guy whose sign-in is Pony Up." That and the few bucks I had managed to save from the one and only time anyone ever asked me to babysit got me a one-way Amtrak ticket to L.A. and a huge mushroom burger with Swiss cheese at Red Robin once I got there. I decided to forego the tip, which left me enough for a tall strawberry malt. Then I asked for the nearest law office. I wasn't without a plan. I knew I had to act quickly if I didn't want to spend the night on the street, and I was careful who I talked to. Always a woman, always businesslike. No one in high heels or a short skirt, but solid looking, not too plain. These are women who know stuff. I was direct and almost truthful. "I'm 16 and pregnant," I said. I was actually still 15, but I continued. "I want to find someone good to give my baby to." Later, I thought I could have formed it as a question and added, "please," but using my voice was new, and I was content enough just getting the words out. He was a boy. 7 pounds, 2 ounces. The first part of having him was scary, but I warmed up to the pushing. It was like jumping on that Amtrak out of Barstow. It gave me something important to do, but it was an activity that ended all too soon. My only real regret, and it's one I think of often now that I'm older, is that I never saw his eyes. I held him, marveled at his fingers, ran my thumb between his toes, smelled his neck, but his eyes were swollen closed, and even pushing the lids up as far as I could, all I saw was the dark hope of an eye that would remain closed to me, would never see me. I accepted that. His parents were outside waiting, and I didn't dawdle. I told the nurse she could bring them in. I looked down at him for the last time, his face twisted and searching just seconds before relaxed into a momentary peace, eyes still closed, and I bent over and whispered, "Your daddy doesn't know what he's missing, and I guess I won't either. But for now, I feel very, very good about you." I wasn't prepared for the look on the woman's face when she entered the room. She had been crying, which I found amusing at the time since I had been the one doing all the work. I got the impression she had cried the whole time I was in the delivery room and didn't stop when she walked in the door. I expected her to snatch him right out of my arms, but instead she leaned over and kissed me on the forehead. Then she kissed the baby. I thought that was pretty classy, and I knew again that they were right. Then, to my amazement, this woman, who had not stopped chattering in her nervousness every time she came to visit me during the pregnancy, didn't say a word. She stepped aside and let her husband reach down and pick her new boy out of my arms. The baby curled sweetly in his hands. The woman and I stared at the two of them, grateful all around. I couldn't think of a thing to say. I was aware it was the only time in my young life I had ever made anyone happy. Leaving was easy. Going somewhere was hard. Not wanting to be dragged into conversation with a counselor, I had simply said I was going home, and everyone seemed just fine with that. They gave me a little money, more than I needed. I could have gotten more if I had asked. I read about girls who would have taken these people for all they could get. I never would have done that. I don't know how much of a cut the lawyer got. I was grateful they had taken such good care of me up to that point, but it was time to go. I wouldn't have minded going back home to Dad and Mom and even Jason, but I would be expected to return to school, and there was something about returning to life as normal that would have been just like suicide, passing J. Brad in the hall, thinking of myself as Whistle, lapsing into silence. I was used to speaking now, and I didn't want to give it up. It struck me that this would have been a terrific time to have grandparents. Problem was, I didn't really have any. My dad's parents had both died, one before I was born and the other 5 years later in a rest home on the outskirts of town. My mom's mother had run off when Mom was little, leaving what I'm told was a bitter man with three little girls and a liquor cabinet he just couldn't keep stocked. The oldest girl committed suicide when she was in her 30s, and the youngest girl was in South America the year I was born, and that was the last we heard of her. The middle girl was mother, vacant, troubled, depressive. At the best of times, her father's name never came up, even though I had run across some mail he forwarded to mother. He was in Missouri at the time, and I remembered the address on the forwarded mail, a town called Buckland. He was my only option, and my plan was to find him. So I left the hospital in the same clothes I had showed up in when I was pregnant, and was disappointed to discover that they fit about the same. So when I slipped into the law office to say thank you and ask to use the internet, the same green-eyed boy sitting at the reception desk was clearly struggling with what he thought was a déjà vu experience. I laughed at him and wrote a note to the people who helped engineer my baby's fate. I didn't sign it Whistle, as I had done Jason's note. I didn't sign it at all. Then the green-eyed boy let me use one of the computers, and I did a quick internet search, MapQuest and train schedule. The veranda spread out like a cool gray stage, and yellow butterweed grew out from the stairs and the huge cracks in the sidewalk. I was glad he saw me when he did, because if our eyes hadn't connected, I'm sure I would have turned around and walked away. Not even in the lawyer's office did I feel this nervous. I had imagined him in a rocking chair, but he was sitting on the top step reading the paper. He looked at me with unrestrained curiosity, and I realized then I must have been looking at him the same way. Courtesy compelled me to climb the steps and say something. I have always been one to read, and in the background of written word, I'm a player. I connect. I'm a friend to the author, a peripheral character, articulate and bright. But in real time and with real people, I sound shy of intelligent thought, and my voice is alien, weird. And here was no exception. My words were hoarse, and if it weren't bad enough, just sounding artless, I managed to compound the problem by repeating myself. I think you are my grandfather, and I need a place to live for a while, and I think you are my grandfather. I realize in hindsight that I could have scripted this better. Nothing changed in him, not his pose or his gaze, and I suddenly wished I knew more about what compelled my mother to leave her family here in Missouri and come to Barstow all those years ago. Perhaps I was making a very big mistake. On a train? Did you come here on a train? He said. Well, yes, sir. I had never said sir to anyone in my life. I wondered where it came from. I also wondered what clue I could possibly have given him that I had traveled by train. I looked down to see if a ticket stub was hanging out my pocket. It wasn't. I pulled a yellow butterweed that had stubbornly found its way to the top step and looked down at it as though it were the key to my future. You hungry? If he had asked 2 minutes earlier, I'd have said no. But at that point, I realized I was very hungry, and I tried to remember when I'd eaten last. But I put the yellow flower in my jeans pocket and didn't say a word. He got up from the stair and walked through the front door, holding the screen so I could follow. I expected him to make me a sandwich or something, but he creaked up the stairs, leaving me standing by a couch. When he came back, it was with keys. It was a white Ford pickup, a reasonably current model, and he didn't even ask if I had a license, which I didn't. Just handed me the keys and got in the passenger side. It was an automatic, which was helpful, but I had to rely heavily on the 2 weeks of driver's ed under my belt. He didn't appear to be of an age that was beyond driving, so I assumed he did this to make me feel at home. He gave me directions with no further reference to my situation or my driving skills. The next thing I knew, I was sitting in a booth in the local diner, my elbows sticking to a plastic cloth with blue checks and orange flowers. The waitress didn't have a pad, but she wore an apron, most likely the first one handed to her 30 years earlier when she embarked on this career. She was not the least bit shy about asking who I was and why I was there, and this was not something I had anticipated. Getting my granddaddy to take me in was the only hurdle I had considered, and I had sailed over it pretty smoothly so far, but I wasn't prepared for this waitress. "This here's my granddaughter, only one I got," he said definitively. Then a pause. "Lenny." She looked me over real careful and seemed to burrow right into my personal space, and then she said, "I know what your granddaddy's going to order, but I don't know what you want." "You like turkey?" he said. "They make a fine dressing on Thursdays. Turkey's okay, too, but the dressing, oh, man." "Is it Thursday?" I asked. He laughed. "Only if there's dressing." "There's dressing," she said, like, let's get on with this, but not that unkindly. "Yes, please, turkey and dressing. And may I have a Coke?" "Yeah, we have Coke," she said, even though I was asking him, not her. Then she motioned to an older couple who just walked in. "Velma, meet Al's granddaughter, Lenny." So just like that, I became Lenny. Not as common as Jennifer and not as offbeat as Whistle. I liked it fine. That night, Al introduced me to no less than 22 people, ranging from Velma, who had to be about 112, to a three-month-old hairless creature in a yellow blanket. He made no explanation of where I had come from or how long I would stay or why I was there, though questions were asked. I watched him carefully how he handled those questions, since he couldn't begin to know the answer to any of them, and he got through it all by ignoring them. Somehow that worked. People sort of got caught up in the joy of the moment. They obviously liked him fine, and by extension, they liked me. I started to relax. That one evening, I received more attention than I had in all the years I'd lived in Barstow. So a month went by, and I was graciously, gratefully accepted. No questions asked, not by Al. I actually started talking, exactly what I was famous for not doing in Barstow, first to Al, then slowly to old arthritic Velma, who brought over baked chicken once a week, then to the woman at the library, the boy who cut Al's lawn and pulled at the yellow butterweed, who played checkers on the porch and drank Coke, which Al made a habit of having in stock now. Al was kind, attentive, but he seemed to know when to step aside and give me some space. He told me his plans, how he'd been waiting for me to show up like it was something we had discussed over the phone since I was little. He talked about me taking over the house eventually, and it seemed to give him pleasure to lay out possibilities and groom me for the future. I began to feel like I was meant to be there with him, that here finally was family I could be part of, be happy with. So, when he sat me down and told me he had something to tell me, I figured it was another admonition to consider attending college, something he had been sporadically harping on. I certainly didn't expect him to tell me he wasn't really my granddaddy, that he was no relative of mine at all. The result was a blow I was in no way prepared for. If my real dad had actually come home for more than a day at a time while I lived in Barstow and told me after 15 years of living there that he and Mom weren't my real parents, I would have said, well, duh, like I couldn't figure that out. It would have all made sense, maybe even been a relief. So why was this so hard? I had been here 1 month, 27 days to be exact, and this admission left my lungs howling for air. I couldn't speak. Your granddaddy is Harlan, he said. Not me, honey. Not Al. But this house, I said. Mother's high school reunion invitations, like clockwork, every 5 years were forwarded from this address. That's how I found you. This isn't your house?
No. This here is my house. I bought it from Harlan, 7 years ago. He needed the money, and I always had my eye on this old house, since I was a kid, actually. Harlan and I were friends. We are friends. I keep an eye on him, and I forward your mother's mail.
My granddaddy is alive, and he's not you? The whole town was in on this?
No, child. They don't know you belong to Harlan, not me. But I thought you should know.
I went up to what he had told me was my room, and I had no intention of ever coming out. Squatter. I called myself silently. Squatter's rights. You can't make me leave here. I'll slip back into that familiar space of not talking. Nothing I had ever been through in Barstow, none of it, none, hurt me like this old man who turns out was no relation to me at all. Squatter's rights. You can't make me leave. You and this stupid town will have to burn this house down, carry me out in an ashtray. I'm not leaving, and I'm not talking. He left me there all night, sitting on the floor by the window, muttering. I could hear him sitting on the other side of the closed door all night as well. I think I fell asleep sporadically, my neck stiff from whatever lobbed-over position I woke to. Sometime around 9:30 in the morning, he knocked on the door and handed me the pickup keys. Despite my vow the night before not to ever leave that room, I took the keys, telling myself I wasn't going to let this major adjustment in our relationship alter my driving opportunities. We didn't talk. I sort of knew where we were headed, though. He directed me to a meandering establishment the next county over, and it was there that I met my real granddaddy. This was not a pleasant experience. Not only did he not recognize Al, he made no attempt to piece together the elements of Al's explanation of who I was. Never so much as looked at me. Worse, I could see my mother's eyes in his deeply lined sockets, and I knew this was the real deal, my granddaddy. There was no joy in that discovery for either of us. Back in my upstairs room later that day, for the first time since kindergarten, I cried.
I felt a loss I couldn't express any other way, and I envied my baby boy, wishing my own mama had found some law firm all those years ago that she could dump my future on. I was filled with pity for myself, and once released, years of grief streamed my pillow, the back of my hand, the corner of the sheet, the sleeve of my T-shirt. Well into the night I cried, and when nothing was left but yawn and fatigue, I heard Al at the top of the stairs. I opened the door, and there he was, sitting on the top step just like the night before, his back to me. He scooted over toward the wall and patted the landing in a gesture designed to invite me to sit. I did. I was curious, but I had no energy to voice it. Sitting next to him was my only hope to make sense of my life, and I sat like a heavy sigh on the landing next to the stranger who had managed to become everything to me. I can't remember how he started. I didn't engage mentally myself until he was well into his story, the introduction of which is lost to me now. As I write this, he has been gone almost a year, and there are many things I miss, but this evening of talk, with the exception of how he began it, is something I still inhale and hold inside me like warm air, filling, sustaining, real. His voice was low and didn't crack, though at places I thought it would. He spoke down the stairwell most of the time rather than to me. He spoke of things deeply concealed, images brittle and firmly stored since childhood. I listened, fascinated. I couldn't help it. I came here on a train, just like you. An orphan train, he said. One of the last. Weren't no orphan, I tell you what. My mama took my baby sister and went up to Canada to live with her aunt. She promised she'd send us money. Daddy couldn't get no work and after a while didn't try. Robert and I stole potatoes from one of the street vendors, and eventually Robert got to sell newspapers. Robert's my big brother. Gets cold in New York. You wouldn't have a clue, Lenny, being a California girl. We lived in sort of a tent for a while, but Daddy said with winter coming, that wasn't going to do. I liked the tent fine. Robert was selling papers, so he wasn't there much. The point is, and he looked at me briefly, I was no orphan. I had a family, just like you got a family. I hadn't thought about my family recently. I didn't really miss them. I wasn't sure what this story had to do with me and the fact that he had pretended he was my granddaddy. Living in a tent in New York City, though, was interesting, so I listened. It was comfortable listening to him, like reading. It was such a long walk. That's what I remember. Such a long walk. And he wouldn't say where we were going. Robert figured it out before we got there, even after he left us and we were in cots. Even then, I didn't really understand. He left you? Your dad left you? Al ignored my questions like he had ignored the people in the diner that first night. So you know about the orphan trains, he finally said. I never heard of orphan trains. Well, it was a good idea at the time, I guess. It got me here, and since it got me here and you're here, well, I guess we both owe him something, don't we? I didn't know how to answer that, so I just said what was on my mind. You were an orphan? He seemed briefly irritated. No, I told you, I had a family, just like you have a family. I wasn't no orphan, but me and Robert, we were stuck in this orphanage, just waiting for our daddy to come back and get us, or mother to send for us, or something. Well, they had way too many of us, so they put, I don't know, 30 or 40 of us on a train and sent us out west, hoping there'd be people out here who could use us. You know, take us in, adopt us. Daddy, he may not have known we was going, hard to say. We never saw him again, at least I didn't. I used to feel so sorry for him, thinking what my mother would do when she found out he had just left us there. Robert told me not to worry. He was coming back. He had a plan. We were there because we'd get fed. But he didn't come back, at least not in time. So they put you on a train, just like that, on a train to nowhere? Oh, it happened all the time back then. It was smooth at first, so smooth like we was something special. We got new clothes, and they let us eat on the train better than we ever had. We stopped here and there, and they'd clean us all up and sit us out on a stage like in a gym or a church or something, and people would walk around us and ask us questions. They sent flyers out ahead saying an orphan train would be through at a certain time on a certain day, and people just showed up. You'd be amazed. People showed up at every stop, most of them just to look. Well, it sounds like they were shopping. It was okay. More fun than the orphanage. Robert filled my head with stories about cowboys and Indians, told me we'd see things that just don't happen in New York. But the horses I saw were big, solid things fashioned for working, not chasing bandits. Still, they were horses, and it was an adventure until, and Al stared distant down the stairwell. Well, until someone took Robert. I hadn't expected that. The young ones went first was what I noticed. Didn't figure anyone would want me or Robert, not right off anyway. And I always just assumed they'd want both of us. How could they not take us both? We were brothers. The guy said Robert looked like he'd make a fine worker, and then Robert was gone. They took your brother? How old was he? Oh, he was 10. I was 7. He tried to turn toward me, but they disappeared him straight away so fast you could barely see the struggle. Well, what did you do? Oh, I can't rightly remember. I know I tried to run after him, but the placement lady had me firm. I think I hit her. But that might be what I dreamed later that night. Probably was. Can't imagine hitting a lady. Sure wanted to, though. Al stood up now and walked down the stairs. I followed him. I hadn't realized it had turned so dark, and I wondered vaguely what time it was, not really caring. The light was on in the kitchen, and we followed it like insects follow crumbs. He puttered around the stove, boiling water and making hot jello. He told me he invented hot jello as a drink and couldn't understand why anyone would put something like that in a fridge and wait until it turned into jelly. That month, hot jello had become my favorite evening snack. He kept little glass containers of jello powder on the table for me. Green, I said, and he spooned granules of dry lime jello into my cup of hot water as I stirred. The next two stops after Robert left, no one wanted me, he said. I knew the more stops down, the farther I would be from Robert. And I started getting nervous because anyone they didn't want got sent back to the city. I didn't mind going back to the city. I just minded going back without Robert. Tell you what, Lenny girl, I did some crying on that train. You probably think crying is your job. But if you had seen me on that train, tell you what, you'd know who invented crying. It occurred to me suddenly that I really hadn't cried much before I got to Missouri. I pondered that briefly, waiting for him to start up again. The worker woman who placed us took me off one morning and told me I could cry all I wanted at night, but I better be snot-free in the morning or no one would want me. I know she was trying to be helpful. She didn't want to take me back to New York any more than I wanted to go without Robert. She told me to find someone with nice eyes and say, "Let me be your little boy, sir. You won't ever regret it." I tried it once, but it didn't sound too sincere, and I don't think it fooled no one because no one bit. I remember the towns. I do. I tried to memorize them, thinking I would find my way back to Robert. I remember Elmer and Ethel because a placement lady told us those towns were named after children of bigwigs of the Rock Island line. Even then, I saw that as some kind of irony, like we were orphans showed off in a whistle stop named for kids by doting rich fathers. I remember Hart, then Buckland, of course. It was here in Buckland when I started thinking there was no way I was going to remember all those names, even if some of them was children of important men. The placement lady kept giving me signs not to cry, and I was doing my best. Suddenly, I heard a woman's voice. I heard her before I saw her, and she said, "I want the boy with the sad eyes, Al. He's the one I want." And I looked up, and there was two people looking down at me. I was that boy. "Here?" I asked. "Right exactly here." "Are you saying you were adopted by the people in this house, like my family?" Well, not quite. I was taken in by an older couple. Those are the ones who saw me, who lived on your great-grandfather's property. The wife had been a good friend of your great-grandmother, and her husband helped farm the land. They rented a little house on the edge of the property here. It was torn down years ago, but it was my first home out here. So you were taken in. What does that mean, taken in? Well, they couldn't adopt me. I wasn't no orphan. I told them straight out I had a daddy and somewhere in Canada, a mother. But things were different then. They just took me in, named me, and I was theirs. Simple as that. My name in New York was Clark. My new daddy was Al, and that's what they named me, too. Al. Did you like him? I mean, did you, like, ever love them? For a long time, I couldn't think of anything to complain about, so I guess I liked him fine. Didn't know that I loved him until 4 years later when Robert showed up looking for me. Your brother? Yeah, he hadn't fared so good. Folks who got him worked him hard, didn't feed him much, never really treated him like part of a family. He ran away looking for me. When he found me, he told me he was going back to New York to find Daddy and would take me with him. At first, I was open to the idea, but his terms were not to my liking.
He had terms?
Yeah. He told me we had to take off late at night without telling anyone. The thought of doing that to Al and my new mom, well, it was like what Daddy had done to me and Robert. I couldn't do it. It was then that I knew I loved them. I would never hurt them, and I would never leave them. So I told Robert, and the next morning he was gone. I never saw him again.
You never hurt them and you never left them?
Well, I joined the Navy for a time. That hurt them. But I came back, haven't left since.
Didn't marry?
I knew better. I saw pictures. I knew he was married. Well, that's a funny story as it happens. There was a girl went to my school who had been on another orphan train a few years before me. Sometimes kids would make fun of us for being orphans. It was no use me trying to tell them I wasn't really an orphan, but this girl, well, she was. And it hit me. We still had something in common. When I got back from the Navy, I married that girl, Lenny.
Lenny? Her name was Lenny, like me?
Quite precisely like you, he said. She died years ago. We never had no children till you, of course.
You named me after Lenny? I said as though I were repeating something he had just said. At this point, he looked me straight in the eye.
It just came right back around. You standing on that porch there with those sad eyes, I could just hear someone whisper, I want that one with the sad eyes, Al. It was Lenny. It was her voice. I want that one with the sad eyes. And I thought to myself, and it must have been the same darn thought my new daddy had all those years ago. I just looked you over and I thought to myself, well, okay, you'll do. And here you are. And you do just fine. From now on, this is your house. And I'm your granddaddy, just like I picked you off a stage filled with orphans like they did me all those years ago. Simple as that. We don't need to explain ourselves to nobody unless we choose to. You want more Jell-O?
I chose orange.
He said it looks like orange, but it's really tangerine. And he spooned it into the same cup that had held the green. Friday is Velma's birthday. I think we should make her a cake.
Did you know, I said, that there are cake mix recipes you can put a whole box of Jell-O in? I saw it in a magazine somewhere. I always wanted to do that.
So we went to the library the next day looking for that magazine, never found it. But we got a recipe off the internet that did the same thing. We decided on lemon, same color as the butterweed by the front porch.
And that was our own Judy Ryan reading a gripping story about a young woman named Whistle who turn out to be about the loneliest gal in all creation. As she herself tells it, I had been ignored by my mother, emotionally abandoned by my father, taunted by my brother, overlooked by my teachers, discarded by a sexual partner, but none of it hurt me like this kind old man who, it turned out, was no relation to me at all. I did a little research about those orphan trains, which were a prominent part of Judy's story tonight. Here's what I found out. For 80 years, roughly between 1850 and 1930, 100,000 children were sent from the cities on the eastern seacoast via orphan trains to new homes out west. Here's one of those kids' stories. 8-year-old Elliot was put on such a train. His mom had died and his dad hit the bottle pretty hard. Before any orphan train would stop at various towns, handbills advertising the needy children on board were distributed. So then, as the trains pulled into town, the youngsters were cleaned up and paraded onto makeshift stages before crowds of prospective foster parents. And here's how little Elliot tells it. A farmer came up to me and felt my muscles. "You'll make a good hand," he said, and I told him, "You smell bad, probably because you haven't had a bath in years." That's when he grabbed my arm and was going to lead me off the stage, so I bit him. He said he didn't want me because I was out of control, and I ended up just sitting in my chair, crying. Friends, Judy Ryan received her bachelor's in English from Sacramento State and her master's from Fresno State. She's a full-time English instructor at Fresno City College, where, among other distinctions, she serves on the Honors Advisory Board. She collaborated with two of her colleagues on writing an English textbook. As we stated at the outset, we not only thank Judy for the fine stories that she herself contributed to our show, but also thank her for the fact that she has made herself available to interpret the works of other writers, and we greatly appreciate that. Thank you, Judy, for your continuing support. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writer-reader will be Debbie Everson Barofka. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.